The Kevin O'Connor Show is coming up next. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. Wanted to open today's show talking about one of the key games from Thursday night in the NBA, and that was the New York Knicks going into Minnesota and completely trouncing the Timberwolves 133-107. What a homecoming for Karl-Anthony Towns. Before the game, he says he's still a fan of the Timberwolves. Minnesota is still a home to him. And then he goes in and he has 32 points, 20 boards, 6 assists, showing exactly why the Knicks went out and got him. And why this year has been absolutely ugly for Minnesota. They're now 14-12 on the year. They're on the outside looking in of the top 6 guaranteed spots in the Western Conference playoffs. They don't look like a contender. They look more like a dysfunctional mess. Classic case of a team that tried to win way too early in the journey of a superstar young player, Anthony Edwards, still only 23 years old. And more is being asked of him right now than he's able to provide. Because you watch Minnesota this year, you watch him on Thursday against the Knicks, and he is holding the team back as a playmaker. That's specifically because of the needs of this year's team. They need more from him as a playmaker. You're seeing teams sending two at him more often, more gap help, more rim help, and he's not making his teammates better as a passer. But he's still only 23 years old, and it's a lot to ask from him when he already is needing to adapt, shoot more threes because there's not at-rim chances. The paint is clogged because there's a bunch of non-shooters on the team. Julius Randle ruins spacing. He has nights he gets hot, but for the most part, teams aren't defending him like he's worth it. Dante DiVincenzo has forgotten how to shoot. He's having the worst season of his career, barely shooting over 30% from three. This team as a whole, they're so stationary. There's no movement on ball. They're frustrating to watch. They're not even fun to watch. Jaden McDaniels, the guy they paid a boatload of money, has not developed at all. Rudy Gobert, I love him. I love the dude. I think he's a legendary defender, but offensively, he can barely catch the ball, can't do anything away from the basket. And so you have this team with a lack of spacing, a lack of movement. It's no wonder why Anthony Edwards says, oh, I guess in order to score, I need to start shooting a ton of threes. That's why he did so much of this earlier in the year. And so, yes, Anthony Edwards needs to be better as a playmaker, but he's also 23 years old. And it's a lot to ask of him at this point of his career when most guys don't win championships until they're 26, 27, 28 years old. And so for Ant at this stage of his career, he's the face of a franchise that accelerated things around him too fast, too fast. It's pretty clear at this point. I know they went to a West Finals last year. I know there was the Jordan comparisons for Ant, but it all was too fast. They accelerated too quickly. And now they're in a position where they have no tradable first-round draft picks in the future because of the Rob Dillingham trade. That's why the Spurs made that bet. They traded number 8 for future draft capital because they're betting that Anthony Edwards is going to be like, peace out, Minnesota, that he's not going to pull the Kevin Garnett, that he's going to be the guy that's going to decide to go somewhere else because this front office decided to go fast. The new ownership, well, kind of new ownership, but we'll see how that all shakes out. They wanted to win now. And so if you're a Wolves fan watching this team, I'd have a hard time feeling a lot of optimism. And that sucks to say a year after you go to the Western Conference Finals. But the big deals you made for Rudy Gobert, yes, it has given you an elite defense. Yes, it positioned you for a ton of wins. But then the big deals you made after that, trading Karl-Anthony Towns, bringing in what you did, feels like the team got worse. Feels like the team got worse. And now there's really no outs because the young players don't play or haven't shown any value. The guys like Rob Dillingham, it's a lot gambled on him to actually be that creator on this team. And even then, there's still fundamental flaws with the roster construct. Randall's got to go. Like, they got to get rid of Julius Randle. I don't know if it's now ahead of the deadline or this offseason, but they need to get rid of Julius Randle and invest more in Naz Reid. That's the number one thing they got to do. I don't think you can let go of Gobert despite his flaws as a player. You need to continue investing in him with your defense and make the roster work. But this team feels stuck. And if you're a Wolves fan, can you really argue against the Spurs' belief that maybe in 2 or 3 years, Ant does ask out? Can you really come up with a good argument for that right now? Because I can't. It looks very bleak for Minnesota. It feels hopeless. Whereas on the Knicks side of things, you have Kat, 32 points, 20 boards, 6 assists. Karl-Anthony Towns, perfect from 3. And his banger of a performance back in Minnesota, shooting over 40% from 3 in the season. There's a great stat in Dan Devine's article over at Yahoo Sports, published on Thursday ahead of the game. And he wrote, last season, 10% of New York shot attempts came against tight coverage. Now, what that means is tight coverage is what the tracking data defines as shots taken when a defender is within 2 feet of the player. It's not perfectly accurate, but it's a good, at least, estimate of the amount of tough shots that a team takes. And Knicks fans know the Knicks offense took a lot of tough contested shots last season. Well, Dan found that this season, that's down to 6%. To me, that is clearly the effect of Karl-Anthony Towns with the floor spacing. We've seen Jalen Brunson and Karl-Anthony Towns run more pick and rolls than anybody in the NBA together, besides Damian Lillard and Brooke Lopez. So it's second most pick and rolls in the NBA. They're one of the most efficient duos. They are potent together. Karl-Anthony Towns individually has been dominant. They've been scary offensively. It's one of the best offenses in the NBA. I wonder what the Knicks are going to do to fix their defense. I know they held Minnesota to 107 on Thursday night. It wasn't their worst offensive performance by any mean, but their defense is concerning. It still is. But unlike the Minnesota Timberwolves, the Knicks still have some picks that they can trade. They have a 2025 top 13 protected first from Detroit that's probably not going to convey, but it would be another first in 2026. They have a top 10 protected first from Washington, also in 25, which becomes less protected in 26. So they have swaps as well, 26, 30, and 31 that they can trade. So they have a little bit of wiggle room. They still have guys that they can deal. If they really wanted a flip, say a Miles McBride, who a very nice young player who I prefer to keep, I love McBride, they have some pieces that they can move. So I think for the Knicks, you have Mitchell Robinson coming back. You hope he can stay healthy. Maybe you do something with those picks for somebody on the edges of the roster and you round out this team. The thing is, when I think about the Knicks defense, like Tibbs, Mikal Bridges doesn't need to be leading the NBA in minutes. Mikal Bridges is over 38 minutes per game, leads the NBA. He does not look like the same level defender that we've seen in the past. Lateral movement, he just looked cooked in comparison to his prime years. And I wonder if that's minutes. I wonder if that's role expectations, or maybe he's just lost it defensively. He needs to get better, though, and I think lessening his minutes would be nice. So maybe finding some depth at wing, something like that could be helpful. But overall, though, the Knicks have three of the top eight players in minutes per game. All five of their starters are in the top 38. They're the only team in the NBA with five players in the top 100 for minutes. So fatigue, maybe it's related to minutes. The Knicks are 11th in defensive rating in the first three quarters of games for the entire season. They're 29th in fourth quarters. Still working with small sample sizes when it's not even January yet. But I do find some of these things quite indicative of what might be a fatigued, tired team. We saw it happen in the playoffs. Maybe it's happening a bit in the postseason. But hopefully Mitchell Robinson coming back does help out that defense. Hopefully they're able to make a move around the edges. Because Cat has this team alongside Jalen Brunson and OG Anunoby having a career year and tons of good positive aspects of that offense as one of the five best offenses in the league. So if they can make that defense better, I believe the Knicks still have a chance to be a contender come playoff time, unlike the team they traded with in Minnesota. They look out. Coming up next on the Kevin O'Connor Show, we got Tom Haverstraw talking about the NBA Cup and a whole bunch else from the week that was in the NBA. Joining me once again today is Tom Haverstraw from YahooSports.com. Tom, we saw the NBA Cup this week. The Bucks beat the Thunder 97-81. An absolutely amazing performance by Milwaukee. I want to start on the Bucks side of things in this game because I thought Giannis Antetokounmpo, it was one of his better games of what has been an absolutely sensational season because of just the way he was in complete control of the game. 26 points, 19 boards, 10 assists, 5 stocks. I thought he was masterful. The passing, those 10 assists, when the Thunder built a wall for him in transition, he found open shooters. When the paint was packed in the half court, he made kickouts to the corner. When he was posting up back to the basket, the Thunder would send two a lot of the time. He would find cutters at the rim. The pace he played with, the feel that he played with, I thought we have seen this version of Giannis many times before, but this guy, this feels like the most seasoned version of Giannis that we've ever had this entire season, and it was put on display against the Thunder.
Yeah, what a performance. I mean, a lot of people are putting him ahead of Jokic and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander.
Me included.
There you go. That performance was a signature performance of the season, even though it doesn't quote-unquote count and...
So like silly.
It's very odd that we're talking about this signature moment MVP for performance that doesn't count towards the standings or the stats, but it's true. Like the way he commanded that game, and one of the moments that I loved in that game, Kev, was there was a big play. They had a great stop, and the whole team is going nuts on the bench, and he is seen on TV going like this, like calm down, like he does a motion to them, calm down. Like leadership of like, yo, next play, oh, we got to get back. We got to continue to push and forget about that play, next play attitude. And that was like real leadership by Giannis, where it was, you know, Dame Lillard's on the team, Brooke Lopez. We know that he's got leadership qualities. He's the face of the franchise. But I thought that was a really cool moment to see where Giannis had this kind of act like you've been there attitude of a champion who wants to win this NBA Cup and it matters to him. But the way that he was able to pick up the slack playmaking wise without Chris Middleton in the game, Chris Middleton is probably their best passer, best connector in the lineup. He was out with the flu. And then Giannis just does that. I mean, that looks like an MVP right there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he absolutely did. I moved him ahead of Jokic. I thought last week I said to somebody in a replies on X, I was like, well, he's top two, top three, maybe number one. And I think at this point, he is number one over Jokic. They have the same record. You know, I think the Bucks, if you look at the Bucks and the Nuggets, same record, different seeding in the respective conferences. But for Giannis, the defensive impact is just so much more significant. We saw that against the Thunder. They had him a lot of the time either helping off of Lu Dort, and when the ball would find Lu Dort, he would close out. When he was defending Alex Caruso, a lot of the time he would just blatantly ignore him and completely shut down the paint. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Jalen Williams, they did not have great performances. 8-for-20 for J-Dub, 8-for-24 for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. That's in large part due to Giannis's help defense. They held the Thunder to a season low 12 shots in the restricted area, according to the tracking data. They forced them into a season high 21 shots in the paint non-restricted, a season high 21 shots from mid-range. So the Bucks came in with a game plan. Giannis was the centerpiece of that. And we see them hold the Thunder to 81 points. And it wasn't just the fact OKC struggled from three. 5-of-32 in the game. It wasn't just that. It was from inside the arc what Giannis and Brooke Lopez collectively forced.
Yeah, when Giannis is able to do the verticality and stop Hartenstein from getting to the rim, and then Iheart has to kind of like do this little dump pass, and it's basically a turnover because of Giannis. Like that's another level that he doesn't do it every game. Like he stopped doing that routinely because he realizes like, if I'm going to have a 20-year career, I can't be doing playing like game seven and playing like a crash test dummy every single night. Just can't, it's not great for his long-term, but when in big games, when he's able to do that, there's nobody better on the planet when he's impacting the game on both ends of the floor. You mentioned
to your point, Tom, to your point about Giannis on the defensive end, first 3-4 weeks of the season, he was doing that pacing thing that you're talking about. But ever since then, when they realized, oh, damn, like we got to turn this season around, he's been in that every game's a big game mode. And I think that's in part why I have him one on MVP right now. But what were you saying about the shooting aspect?
Yeah, I mean, the shooting, we have to talk about the shooting because OKC, this is kind of their weakness, is the idea of they don't have enough scoring or at least three-point shooting to contend at the highest levels. And just to, you know, reiterate here, it wasn't just the raw three-point field goal percentage. It was the fact that they were 1-of-15 on unguarded catch-and-shoots in this game, according to Synergy Sports Tracking. I went back and looked at that. 1-of-15, 3 points on unguarded catch-and-shoots, according to their tracking. That is the lowest point total for the Thunder in the last 99 games on unguarded catch and shoots. So off the pass, open three, they only got 3 points in that game, in that cup, and they average 19 per game, 19 points on average on open three catch and shoot 3-pointers. this is an anomaly. It's an outlier. And of course, on the other side, the Bucks hit their shots. Like Torian Prince, like people don't realize that he has been absolutely money. He has been Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, Kevin Herter-esque, Kyle Korver-esque, not on that kind of volume, but still, he's been a really good catch and shoot three guy, the best field goal three-point field goal percentage in the NBA, shooting over 50%. And then you got, of course, you got Derry Bird over there and Andre Jackson Jr., these guys hitting, you know, their shots more than Oklahoma City Thunder, and they were 7 of 18 on catch and shoots while open in that NBA Cup final. And that difference between 21 points on open catch and shoots and 3 points on the OKC side, the difference of 18 points in that column explains the deficit overall of 16 points. So if they hit their shots, OKC, at an average rate, what they were getting, that's a totally different game, KOC. And I know it's not a sexy explanation for what we saw, and Giannis was great, but if OKC just hits a few of those, I think it's a totally different game.
I think that's true. However, we did see OKC run into some of the same issues in the playoffs against Dallas. We saw that again in against the Bucks in the NBA Cup Championship. And part of it, I mean, like you're going to have games where you didn't shoot the ball well, but it's not like it hasn't been a season-long back-of-your-mind concern when you talk about OKC. As the favorites in the West, they have check almost every box, but 19th in the league in three-point percentage. They are not an elite three-point shooting team yet. They have a lot of good shooters on their team, but they don't have any really great shooters minus Isaiah Joe, who also wasn't good shooting the ball, shooting well in that game. So I think with SGA, Jalen Williams, they enter the season. They're trying to shoot more threes off the dribble, even more off the catch. They did not shoot the ball well in that game either. Those guys needing to be better as a shooter, I think, is reflective of the concern for this team when it comes to that shooting ability. And I know Chet Holmgren adding him would help. He'd help with shot creation. He's a 38% guy from three in his career, but even he's a very good shooter, not an elite, elite, elite shooter. And his numbers were below 30% against Dallas in that series they lost last year either. I think if you're OKC and you're adding anything at all in the trade market this year, you have to find a shooter, somebody better than Caruso. Because I watch some of these games and I'm like, you know, there's a moment, it's off court. It was a game over the weekend. I think it was a game against Houston. And they're interviewing SGA after the game, and Caruso's just kind of standing in the back. Everybody else is having a good time with that post-game interview, and Caruso's just kind of standing there, like waiting to go to locker room, not really part of it. And I feel like that's the case sometimes watching him on the floor, where he's an unbelievable defender, but you already have a bunch of unbelievable defenders. What you really need in that spot is somebody who's a better shooter. So as much as I love Caruso, he's not shooting the ball anywhere as well as he did last year with Chicago when he was over 40%. Right now he's at 25% with OKC. I just wonder if maybe that's the spot you try to find a knockdown shooter, where those kickouts are going to a guy that's willing to take 7-8 three-pointers a game and not just hit a third of them at two attempts per game, because they ignored him completely.
Yeah, I think there's another thing here, which is Chet Holmgren would change so dramatically. Is they basically guarded Shai Gilgeous-Alexander full court. Mark Daigneault talking about after the game, like, we tried to get him off the ball, Shai.
Oh, man.
Like, we could not have him wearing out because he's trying to go at Andre Jackson.
Dude, Jackson was unbelievable.
Unreal.
Mirrored every single movement. Like, who can stay with SGA with the deceleration, change of pace, change of direction? I was just blown away watching Andre Jackson slow him down.
And they game planned perfectly to take Shai out of the game in that sense. And he wasn't himself. He wasn't. And he had some mid-range Jays. He had a corner three there. They were able to, you know, get some action out of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. But if you, kill the head of the snake there with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, put so much on J-Dub and everybody else to step up, and they didn't. That's why Chet Holmgren, like, he can run the offense. He can get a rebound and dribble the ball up the floor and lead your offense in ways that, like, Alex Caruso, a bunch of other guys on OKC, you can't get that out of them. And Iheart, he's great. He's awesome at what he does, but Chet Holmgren, what he brings both ends of the floor, is a huge, huge factor in why I don't think that they played all that well in that NBA Cup game. And I do think, you know, when we look at the ceiling for OKC, it's got to have Chet Holmgren in there as a foundational piece, or else we're not being fair to the Oklahoma City Thunder. I wrote, KSC, like, I wrote this column because I kind of felt like they are still under the radar nationally. They are not a marquee team, but they are playing like a marquee team in terms of their point differential. One of the best teams ever through 25 games. And even if you look at their SRS, which is schedule adjusted net rating, basically how much they're outscoring opponents once you account for their schedule, they're the best playing at the best level of any team in NBA history. If they can sustain this for 82 games. You throw Chet Holmgren in there, and yeah, I think they should be the title favorites. Now, the issue is,
even over Boston,
they don't have Chet Holmgren.
Even over Boston?
I do, yeah. I think if Chet Holmgren's on that team.
I just can't get there, Tom. I mean, I just can't get there. I can't. The Boston is such better shooting than OKC. Tatum and Brown are seasoned, and that's the difference. Like, SGA is 26 years old. He is seasoned. He has dominated individually in postseasons. He's there. He's ready to be a champion. Jalen Williams is 23 years old. Chet Holmgren is just in his second season coming back from a hip fracture. Like, can we really expect Chet to be his full self? It feels like a big, big, big if for me with OKC. A huge if. And J-Dub, he struggled again in all three elimination games in the Cup, just like he did against Dallas last year. I love Jalen Williams. I think he's going to be a star. I think he's going to be an all-NBA guy, but it might not be until he's SGA's age at 26. And that's where, like, I just wonder, does SGA have that second co-star yet? Like, it's going to have to be by committee with sometimes it's Chet, sometimes it's Jalen Williams, but they don't have that guy you can rely on night in, night out. And that's where I'm like,
Yeah.
Maybe we're actually still a year away or 2 years away with OKC.
They might be. But there's issues over on Boston's side too.
Of course.
Injury questions around Porzingis, and they've got Al Horford at 40 years old playing, so you don't know how much they're gonna get
He's
out of
it. He's only 40. I thought he was 50.
dude, we
He's been around forever, dude.
Do you even remember Al Horford on the Thunder? He played like 30 games on the Thunder.
I know.
Like, before they moved him over to Boston. And that seems like it didn't even happen. And look, after writing that column and then they do that dud in the championship, it reminded me of, like, you know, you wake up from like a bad dream and you're like, that felt so real. But thank God it didn't count. It wasn't real. That's what it felt like for me with OKC, watching that game, being like, man, they looked so bad in this game. All the hype that I gave to them and wrote about, and all the things, all the vibes about them, it mattered nothing. And then I woke up and I went back to the box score on Basketball Reference and it didn't exist. And I was like, y'all, it was just a dream. KOC, it was just a dream. But I want to talk about Giannis real quick. Underrated reason why he's been so good this year. Gotta say it. No more offensive fouls. This guy, Giannis Antetokounmpo, picks up his third foul right at the start of the third quarter. And I'm like, yo, if he gets in foul trouble here, they're done because they don't have Chris Middleton and they're going to have to put everything on Dame. And then all those Dobermans for OKC, they're going to chew them up. And then that game is over. Then he gets a push off on J-Dub that they don't call a foul on Giannis. They call a foul on J-Dub, even though he's in the front row because of that forearm by Giannis. Could have been his fourth foul, and then he goes to the bench. Then he pancakes Cason Wallace on that loose ball foul, and the entire game changes in that third quarter when that happens. Lou Dort gets that ball on the floor. Giannis pancakes him, and then he gets the jump ball. Tech on Dort, Tech on Dagnall, then Dame Lillard hits the three right after that, after the jump ball, and that's a huge swing. That is an absolutely game-changing swing. And after the game, Dagnall didn't say it was officiating, but Giannis Antetokounmpo should have been fouled out in that third quarter based on how physical he was and the push-off and the hook on Cason Wallace to get a bucket in the lane. And this guy, Giannis Antetokounmpo, last 2 years, he has led the league in offensive fouls. And this year, he is nowhere near the top of that leaderboard. And I think that's a big reason why you're seeing Giannis Antetokounmpo being at this level this season, is because he's not in foul trouble. And he has been able to get to the free throw line in ways that, like, Giannis Antetokounmpo is not a good free throw shooter, but he's a great free throw filibusterer. A great free throw filibuster. He's getting an extra timeout of recovery and break to catch his breath every night because he takes 10 minutes at the free throw line. And that matters. When a guy's expending that much energy on both ends of the floor, the way that he can basically take a timeout and gas up at the free throw line is a huge factor, not just this game, but in them winning a championship. When the referees were like, yeah, you can take 30 seconds at the free throw line. We're not going to call that. I think is a really big factor. And I'll just point to this. When he's in foul trouble, four or more fouls in a game, over the last three seasons, they're a 54 win percentage team, or a 540 win percentage team, the Bucks, when he has four or more fouls in a game. That's a 44 win team, okay? When he doesn't, when he has one or fewer fouls in a game, the Bucks over the last three seasons are 28-5. That's a 70 win team. So when Giannis is in foul trouble versus when he's not, we typically see this in the 3-point field goal percentage column. But when Giannis is in foul trouble, when he's not, that's a swing from a 44 win team and a 70 win team. And so I do think the officiating and how he's getting called in a particular game is a pretty big swing factor for the Milwaukee Bucks. And they got one in the NBA Cup final.
Well, Giannis takes his breaks at the free throw line. We'll take a quick break now and be back talking about our NBA Cup thoughts. All right, Tom. So the Bucks win the NBA Cup, and Darvin Ham undefeated in the NBA Cup now as well. And he suggested, apparently, he's the reason they suggested, hey, don't celebrate. And you look at the pictures after the game in the locker room, just a bunch of untouched champagne bottles and goggles. Nobody celebrated on the Milwaukee Bucks.
I hate it.
Nobody.
I hate it. I hate it, KOC, because it means nothing. That's what it means. You're telling the fans that the game didn't mean anything. If you're not celebrating, I think it's kind of emblematic of the social media culture that, like, Darvin Ham is telling, don't celebrate because they're going to use that later for you when you don't succeed. Celebrate. Celebrate your wins. The NBA made this NBA Cup to mean something. And here you have a coach being like, don't celebrate and make it feel like it means nothing. And I think that sends the wrong message to fans. I do. I think that sends the wrong message that you shouldn't celebrate winning the NBA Cup.
I agree, Tom. I hated it. I hate the fact that, I mean, look, I understand Darvin Ham's point. Like, the Lakers win the first one last year and the season kind of declines from there. He gets fired in the end. I understand it from his perspective, but they should have celebrated because this is something to celebrate. Over time, this will build. It already is
huge win.
First year, LeBron James wins NBA Cup MVP. Second year, Giannis Antetokounmpo wins NBA Cup MVP. LeBron James, one of the five greatest players ever. Giannis could end up one of the 10 or even five greatest players ever, depending on how many championships he ends up winning before it's all done. Like, these are two of the greatest players in the history of basketball starting this thing off. Like, the NBA could not ask for anything more with the teams that have actually won it, the players that have represented that MVP for the NBA Cup. And then the team just doesn't celebrate. I think that does send the wrong message to fans, especially considering that there are a lot of fans who are already questioning, what the hell is the point of this? Well, like, what is this? Like, does it mean something that you win a game on Tuesdays and Fridays, but not the other days? What's with these courts? What are all these jerseys? What is this? Why has my team not played since Sunday? What's going on?
I'm not going to complain. Man, my family has seen me a lot more in the last couple weeks than they have in months. So I'm not complaining too much on that level, but I am complaining about the fact that, would they do that if David Stern was running the league? I think they would put the fear of God in those players. Like, you got to make this NBA Cup mean something. Like, play the game. Like, this league is a business, and we need these NBA Cup games to feel big, marquee, showcase. This is huge on ABC. We need these games to feel huge. And when you have a photo after the game of a fully stocked champagne and Michelob Ultras, that's bad PR, and that's bad for Michelob Ultra. That's bad for all your league partners who are like, yes, sponsor our stuff, and we will have all these eyeballs in these celebratory moments. How cool is this going to be when they win in Vegas? And then they just laid a big old fart on that. And it was like, yo, David, I can't imagine what would happen in Secaucus or at the league office if that had happened under David Stern's watch. He would ream through the entire team. Like, you got to make this a product, a sellable product.
I thought Yahoo Sports, our social staff, did a great job cutting up this clip of Giannis, because Giannis, after the game on ESPN, was like, he said, job's not done. And then when he was running into the locker room afterwards, he was like, job is done. Job is done. And so it's like, even Giannis, he's like, wait a minute, is the job done or is the job not done? There's confusion about what this actually means. And I think that's representative for fans as well. Like, wait a minute, what does this mean? I think, to me, this does mean something. The players are competing hard. The coaches are game planning. Both these teams came out with a serious game plan. They were competitive. I think over time this could build. Maybe someday it's more than eight teams. Maybe someday the whole first half of the season is about a seeding for the single elimination tournament, the NBA Cup. Maybe at some point it grows even more. Maybe someday we have 32 team single elimination. Who knows what this becomes over the course of time. But I think for the NBA, if David Stern were in power, there's no doubt the Bucks would have been spraying champagne bottles after the game. And I think there'd be more clarity for the players about, hey, this is what we need to do to build this thing out for our business. And that's been the conversation a lot this week. What is going on in the state of basketball? And it's become a thing more than ever. Years ago, when people were talking about declining NBA ratings, there was a large segment of NBA media that were like, who cares? This doesn't matter. But I feel like now a lot of people are acknowledging, oh, wait a minute, ratings are down 48%. It has become more of a mainstream conversation. And Adam Silver was talking to a small group of reporters this week, and he went to his typical line. He, a lot of the time, has said, well, our social media numbers are high. And that's, again, what he did. He said, if you look at our data points in terms of our business, we had a highest attendance in the history of the league the last 2 years. We have greater social media numbers than any other league. And that's not just not reflective in the TV ratings because of cable and everything else. Do you think Adam Silver is being genuine in that response? Or do you think internally within the league office that there's legitimate concern with the way these TV ratings have declined, Tom?
Does the All-Star game and the way that they've changed it every single year spark any sort of confidence? You know, like that they're okay with the TV ratings or the product, because I think that's emblematic as well, illustrative of the NBA trying to figure out how to get more eyeballs in these tentpole games in the All-Star and an NBA Cup. How do they get more eyeballs to sell to, you know, corporate partners and sponsors, but also to get huge ratings for your audiences to go to the market and say, like, yo, we've got 10 million people watching the NBA Cup final. Forget Emirates. Like, let's go get some other brands to, you know, sponsor other things in the NBA Cup. And they just haven't been able to get the same sort of ratings as you might expect. And I think another thing that happened this week, Kev, that made me think, man, what would David Stern do? Within minutes of the All-Star Game tournament being announced officially, we got a quote on everyone's social media from Kevin Durant saying, I absolutely hate it. Minutes, within minutes, all of that buzz, all of the pomp and circumstance about the new All-Star tournament got totally deflated by Kevin Durant sitting there being like, I absolutely hate this. And it was like, yo, can you imagine like this happening? I keep going back, but like, it just feels like the defense that a lot of the stars are playing against the league office here is not great. It's not great. Kev, like KD saying that was a fly in the ointment. It was not good. That was not a good thing, not a good look. And I know if he feels that way, you want honesty, but you got to understand, like, for the good of the product, a lot of people are taking cues from KD and being like, oh yeah, he told me he hates it. Yeah, I'm not going to watch.
Or are the players feeling simply reflective of the majority of people, and that the players, like many people, are tuning out because of the decisions by the commissioner in the league office? is that possible as well, that maybe KD and some of these players do need to speak out as to say, hey, something's going wrong here. Now, they just signed a mega deal, 10-year TV contract. Everything's good. Money's coming in. Around 3 or 4 years ago, I remember talking to somebody who is in the league office, and I was like, hey, like, are you guys worried about this next TV deal? And the person said to me, they are like, no, we're not worried about this next TV deal. We're worried about the one after that. And I think that is going to end up being the real concern here. These next 10 or so years for the NBA, how do you make this thing work? How do you get fans back? How do you get fans back watching? What are the things that you can do to innovate your broadcast and make it something that people want to choose into, instead of just scrolling TikTok, instead of just watching YouTube 10-minute videos with the best plays from the game? How can you make the two-hour product or into something that people will tune into and stay tuned into? That's the next 10 years. And I don't know everything the NBA is going to do, but I think with Adam Silver, we talk about, like, what would David Stern do? With Adam, that's where my concern is, because some of his other comments that day where he's like, you know, we have this new TV deal, we start streaming next year, we're going to be doing these things from a functional standpoint with all these new options and screens that are available. And he's like, we talk about style of play, and he mentions the proposed rule in Major League Baseball, the golden at bat. The golden at bat, if somebody doesn't know, it's basically at one point in any game, the manager of a baseball team can choose to have any player go to the plate. So, like, the Dodgers could have Ohtani go to the plate, bottom of the ninth, two outs, even though somebody else was supposed to be at the plate. And that's the golden at bat rule. It's not happening in MLB for now. But Adam was basically saying that if we had his terminology was, if we had a quick fix, I'd put it on the table. I don't think the golden at bat rule is a quick fix, but the fact he frames it as that, it's like, to me, that is indicative of where things have gone and where they seem like they're continuing to go.
Well, I think they also, baseball, did the pitch clock, and they made other tweaks to the game, banning the shift. That was an
bigger
aesthetic.
Plates.
Yep. It was a total, how do we make the product better? How do we make it more entertaining?
And real changes, Tom. Real changes about the fabric of the game.
So forget the golden at bat for a second. Like, Rob Manfred did very big moves to get that to be a more entertaining product, and it worked. And I think me included were more compelled to watch a game, not just because Shohei Ohtani's unbelievable and he's box office material in Hollywood now, but also because it's just aesthetically, it's a better game when it's quicker, it's faster. And it just feels like with the shift, there was aesthetically no anticipation or no surprise or no, when a batted ball happened, when a guy cracked a line drive, it used to be like, oh, that's a hit. I know that's a hit. Or I get to see a cool fielding play where a guy's diving or Derek Jeter's trying to go into the hole and probably going under his glove because he's not a good shortstop. Overrated.
That's a good take. How does he have so many gold gloves simply off of name? Absolutely ludicrous. Ridiculous.
Ludicrous. He deserves zero gold gloves.
Thank
there
you.
At shortstop.
Much appreciate
because he had
that,
one
Tom.
Good throw off of one leg in the corner that most players are getting to without needing to do a one-legged
ridiculous.
Throw.
Ridiculous.
We could do a whole podcast on how overrated Derek Jeter is. I know I have a knowing audience here with me. So KOC, this is what I propose. What about the NBA Cup? You do a 2-3-4 scoring system. I proposed it a couple weeks ago in the column for Yahoo Sports. You add a 4-point line at around 40 feet. You bring in the 3-point line to bring it back the mid-range. And so you have a 2-point zone, 3-point zone, 4-point zone, and you bring that in for the NBA Cup. Try it out. See how it goes. Because the problem with the NBA Cup, in my opinion, is you're not drawn to have to watch the game. It feels like a regular season game at home. It might be different in terms of, like, oh, the players will make more money. No one at home cares about that. What they care about is I have to watch what happens. And for me, the Caitlin Clark factor of you have to watch what happens when she's on the floor, you're losing a little bit of that on the NBA Cup. And I think if you do introduce a 4-point line while adding a shorter 3-point line, I think it adds a lot more excitement to the game to see what happens. And like, honestly,
do you want to go shorter product. 3-point line?
Shorter three-point line because it adds so many tougher decisions defensively and offensively. It's not a gimmick. I think right now there's a lot of, I know it's cliche to say there's a sameness in the league, but I do think that it would create a lot more diversity in terms of strategy. And I think it is like aesthetically, I do think it would be different enough or more interesting enough to draw more viewers and to have a difference. Golden at bat, it draws people in because at any moment, hey, my favorite player can come in and it'll create this amazing moment in the game. I don't know how you do that on the NBA side without making a pretty significant strategy change. And it's not going to happen with getting rid of corner threes. It's not going to happen by moving the 3-point line back a couple feet. I think it's going to be something more substantial. Like, you know, Nick Wright suggested dunks worth 3 points. I don't love that idea, but I do love the 2-3-4 idea.
I don't want to add a 4-point line. I'm against the 4-point line. No, thank you. To me, I think it regardless of what you do, like Kirk Goldsberry has wrote in Sprawl Ball, his book many years ago, about letting teams choose their own 3-point line. Maybe you could have some teams that eliminate the corners, some teams that have the line a little closer at the college level. Some teams, maybe it's just deeper. You could have 5, 10 limitless different configurations for the 3-point line. I'm intrigued by that. I think to me, like regardless of where the line is, to me, it's about sometimes things like maybe you bring back hand checking. Players are so skilled, so athletic at this level. And it's every team has a star. Every team has high level role players. The league is so deep with talent. Maybe you just allow defenses to be a bit more aggressive and a bit more handsy. And maybe that's what can simply turn down some of this perimeter dominance that we see. It's not going to solve everything. You're still going to have kickouts, drive and kick, open three-pointers and all that. But I'm just intrigued by starting there, allowing a bit more hand-checking and seeing how that affects the game. And then maybe over the course of time, you think about the line and moving that. Because like you said, whether it's 2-3-4 or eliminating the corners or choose your own three-point line for the home team, whatever it might be, that's going to dramatically change things as well. But let's start with hand checking. Would you want to bring something like that back?
I think the players are just too good that if you allow hand checking, I just think they're too good. Like their handle, their ability to, you know, on a kick out, if you do a drive and kick and you're allowed to hand check at the perimeter, I don't think that really helps you all that much. I don't think it changes the style of play too much, but I do think that like if you allow defenses more of a chance, you will get a lot more physical game and you will get a lot more, I guess, even game. Like it's more fair for the defenders. So I'm with you on that.
And Tom, on that note about like the physical aspect, my concern there would be like playing, you know, devil's advocate to myself. The officiating is horrible. It is so inconsistent. I think it has gotten worse in the last 5 or so years with the wave of hires that they've made. It is worse than it's been in my lifetime watching the NBA. Less consistent than it has ever been. It's never been perfect. Basketball is a hard sport to officiate. Like what they do is tough. It's really tough and it has always been tough. But boy, like I just feel it's worse than ever right now too.
Well, there's a lot of veterans that left, and now you're having to bring in new talent into the NBA refereeing system. There's a lot there, but I think the consistency is something that coaches, players, they harp on a lot. Is like, I keep going back to that play where Lou Dort got just like hydraulic pressed by Giannis Antetokounmpo, and they wait and they wait and they wait, and then they call a jump ball. Couple of weeks ago with Steve Kerr, that Houston game was decided on that play and they call the foul on JK and he was, you know, that was the game deciding call. That Billy Kennedy, like bless his heart, like that was just not a great situation and there's inconsistencies from game to game. And also like, I think the NBA issue of like, how do we get people to watch more games? A lot of it is that stars aren't playing as much. Chris Middleton, Chet Holmgren not playing in that game. LeBron James just pieces out for like 5 days and just no one knows where he went. No one knows when he's coming back. They asked JJ Redick, yo, when is LeBron coming back? And he says, I don't know. That's a bad look. And then like, yeah, like there's things on the margins of KD saying, I absolutely hate the All-Star idea. Maybe that is a good thing. And like that they're like holding Adam Silver in the league office's feet to the fire, being like, this is not a good idea. But ultimately, if you get 95% star availability every single night, like it used to be, I think fans are a lot more locked into the NBA if they know who they're going to watch every night, and that the NBA can market the games saying, yeah, Luka's going to play. Joel Embiid's going to play. LeBron is not going to just be gone and no one knows where he went in the middle of a season. I think if stars, instead of playing 70% of the games like they do now at certain times, if they're at 90, 95%, I don't think we're having this conversation. But the injuries, all of that, I don't know how you fix it without cutting down the number of games.
You know, I'm totally in favor of cutting down the number of games. I think it makes the games matter more. Every game is naturally would make a big difference in the standings. Like if you cut down, the lower you cut down, the better. But I know the challenge is there, considering the fact that you have games to give to the broadcasters that you agreed to, you would worry about losing money. But on the note of LeBron leaving for, you know, 8 days or whatever it was, that's where I do have concerns about like players missing games, even with a shortened schedule. LeBron saw a point in the schedule where there's two games over like an 8 day period for the Lakers. And he's like, wait a minute, I can miss only two games and get 10 or so days off. That would be the case a lot of the time when there's a shortened schedule. I don't think it would necessarily stop players from taking games off, because it would just mean more time off to recover and get healthy. Like, it still could be an issue. It would have to be something that is policed very hard. Maybe salary is tied to games played. That adds a whole new layer of complications, because that would have to be negotiated with the NBPA. So there's a whole lot of complications there as well.
But I think LeBron's not taking or needing that vacation if he's not playing in back-to-backs. He wanted to play all 82 games this year for, I know that's a good goal to have, but it's also not realistic at the miles and the age. Like, he wanted to do 40, it this year.
Almost. 12 more days.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just feels like that was not the brightest thing. And I think JJ said it as much. He's like, I don't know if that's the thing we need to do, is that LeBron is trying to play all 82 games at this stage of his career. But I think having fewer games means that players aren't as banged up. And also you remove a little bit of that excuse of like, hey, it's the fourth game in five nights, or it's the fifth game in seven nights. We can't play Jokic tonight, or we can't play Jamal Murray, or we can't play Joel Embiid. You remove that from the conversation, and you just have more appointment viewing where, man, like the NFL, you know who's going to play every week, and you can build story in those 5 days, 6 days between games, that you just, it's so hard to build stories in the NBA, because as we do this podcast, stories change on a nightly basis, and it's so hard. The ephemeral nature of the NBA schedule, it's so hard to build that storyline. And I just think it would be a huge benefit if they cut down the number of games. But of course, it all comes down to the owners and the players, for sure, too. It's a smaller check.
Yep. And ultimately, I mean, I think when it comes to building story, that makes it a more enjoyable experience for fans to follow. Because, like, just imagine from the NBA perspective, if you had designated days where games were played, instead of there being games every night, you know, Tuesdays and Thursdays, or Tuesdays and Fridays, whatever date you end up choosing can be a night where almost everybody plays. And then maybe on Wednesday is the marquee matchup. It is one game on national TV, and on Saturday, maybe you have three games. You have one starting a matinee at 12:30. That way the international audience has that primetime start. You could have these designated days. And we see hints of that, like Sunday after NFL season is a big NBA day. I remember talking to somebody in the league office years ago. They've said at the time, they were like, well, maybe we have a game air after Monday Night Football. And see how that falls as a numbers wise, how it affects ratings after Monday Night Football, a real late night NBA game. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. There's these ideas that are tossed around, but they don't really happen.
It's the money's flowing in right now. Yeah. You know, Mark Cuban, he reiterated what you said earlier, is like, I'm not worried. Like, I sold the team, and I believe it was Mark Cuban who said, I'm not worried about this contract or this media deal.
It's the next one.
I'm worried about the next one. And so whether I believe Mark Cuban when he says that, or whether he's just like, yo, the casino family just gave me this check, like, I'm out. He probably just cashed out, rather than like a genuine worry about the long-term future of the NBA. But, you know, it is kind of alarming that Mark Cuban, who's very much one of the faces of the league, decides to peace out at a time when it feels like, wait, I thought this was the golden era of the league in terms of the business. It's been growing and growing, growing, and Mark Cuban wants out. I don't know if that's, you know, a canary in the coal mine, or whether it's just the opinion of one individual on when to cash out.
I mean, well, ultimately, I think for the NBA, the changes that they make have to be about the fabric of the game. We saw baseball do that. NFL has done that with rule changes and everything else. NBA needs to be thinking about those things. It can't just be play-in. It can't be just all-star tournament and NBA Cup. These are additive pieces. Sometimes maybe there's things that you need to change about the game actually itself. The latest thing that they changed is the All-Star Tournament. I'm actually in favor of this because the All-Star Game as is stinks. I know certain players want to just see it be East-West that has been non-competitive. To me, this is something at least interesting to experiment with. It's going to be same 24 players for the NBA All-Star Team. Those will be split into three teams of eight. So there'll be three teams of All-Stars and then the winner of the Rising Stars game. And those four teams will face off, with the winner of the first game being the first team to surpass 40 points in the game. I like it, Tom. It's something different. NBA clearly is trying to train the fan to think about tournaments. They're doing it with the NBA Cup. Now they're doing it with the All-Star. Clearly, this is something they want to do. My belief, this is not something sourced, my belief is that they want to have even more tournaments, the NBA Cup, make it even bigger once they eventually expand. So I think this is about training the fan to look for tournaments. So I'm in favor of it. I like it. It's something different. I'm not sure it's going to stick, just like the All-Star Draft didn't stick. So, but I like it for a year. Let's play with some stuff. What do you think?
I like it. I just think that the All-Star Game is a dinosaur because of the fact that the player empowerment era and the social media era has made these stars playing together less of an event. The idea of the All-Star Game used to be like, I get to see these guys all play on the same team. How cool is this? But in the player empowerment era, where you got KD playing with Devin Booker, then he's playing with Kyrie Irving, then he's playing with Steph Curry, LeBron's playing with Kyrie, LeBron's playing with AD, LeBron's playing with D Wade. We don't have this same sort of appeal when they all come together and play in one game. Also, social media. All-Star Game was an event where you got to see these guys interact together for the first time, and there was a lot of marketing around seeing Michael Jordan playing with Kobe or playing with whoever is the Shaq or whoever it is at the star of the moment. And with the access we have in social media and the 24/7 news cycle, it lost a lot of its allure, on top of the fact that these star players are moving around so much. It doesn't feel like as much of an event. So while I'm for the tournament style, in theory, I just think it's fait accompli with the All-Star Game, and I just don't think it's as much of a draw as it used to be.
You think they'll ever trash it? Just get rid of it?
I think so. I think if they make the three-point contest, the dunk contest, and maybe throw something in there, I think what would get the most eyeballs is a regional All-Star Game. Where you come from. You have the DC team with Kevin Durant versus the New York team versus the LA team. You have regions where these guys claim their corners and they're like, yo, I'm from this area of town. Houston's going to take on Dallas, or New York's going to take on DC. I think if you create like an NBA Olympics on All-Star Weekend, that would be way more interesting, because I think the players would care if they're like, yo, I'm repping where I'm from, rather than like, wait, which team am I on today? Oh, okay. Like, I think that would be awesome. Like a regional, like an American Olympics, in the sense of like, you get European versus DC versus New York area versus Bay Area versus LA. That's what I think is the secret sauce they need to invest in.
I mean, that's an interesting one. I wonder if you'll see players getting recruited to different places, kind of like with the Olympics.
Yeah, right.
So it's I moved here when I was 10 years old. I went to high school here. Where should I be? What team should I actually choose? But that's to your point about where you choose, where you say you're from, where you would choose to rep. I'm intrigued by that for some year. I'd like to see USA versus the world as well. I think that'd be super cool.
Because I think the more that it becomes an international game, there is a domestic like nationalism of American players. Like they don't like the fact that the best players are all from Europe and Africa. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think that they will say that publicly, but you saw Team USA. I think there is a certain American pride that is bubbling up here that maybe like Anthony Edwards, other players on, and the fact that I'm drawing a blank on which American NBA stars would care that much to rep the American, you know, hoop scene, like Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, of course, Jalen Brunson, all the Jaylens for that matter.
So many
playing
Jaylens
against like Team Europe, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, it'd be pretty sick. But you know, we'll see. We'll see what the NBA actually ends up doing. I'm looking forward to this All-Star tournament. It's probably going to be a disappointment like most All-Star games are, but at the least I like the tournament concept, so we'll see how it ends up going. Tom, what an interesting week in the NBA, man. NBA Cup, I cannot believe how much the ratings discourse has become a thing. It blows my mind. This used to be something that NBA media used to shut down, and now you got Charles Barkley on Dan Patrick saying start the season in December. You get all these people talking about it more than ever before. I think it at least shows that people still care. People still care if they're talking about ratings being down, if they're talking about what has pushed them away from the game from a fan perspective. It shows that they can be won back. And so for the NBA, I hope that they're at least listening to their fans and thinking about what can we do to win these fans back, so they tune in at 7:30 p.m., and they get to see a basketball game and not 15 minutes of commercials. Starting the games on time. That's my number one thing, Tom. That would be my number one solution. Start the games on time. What are we doing?
You got start time. I say 2-3-4. I love the 2-3-4. Dame Lillard. Dame wants a 4-point line. I'm all for it. I've been for it. And I think it would
do that in the All-Star tournament. Do that in the All-Star tournament. That's what I would do that this February. Make it happen. That's where you can experiment.
Done. Let's make it happen. I want to see it take off. And if you want more mid-range shots or shots from 15 feet, you're not going to get it by expanding the three-point line. You're not going to get it. It's going to be even more of a shot desert, as I wrote about for Yahoo Sports, if you move back the three-point line. I think you got to incentivize players to take shots from all over the floor, and that's where the 2-3-4 system comes from.
Let's see it. Let's try it, NBA. Do it. Listen to Tom. Let's really have fun with the All-Star Tournament. Let's go. Tom, thanks for joining me today. Have a good weekend.
You too, bud.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of The Kevin O'Connor Show. Appreciate Tom Haverstraw for coming on, as he does every single Friday. Thank you to Brett for producing, and thanks to you for giving us a listen. Please give us a thumbs up if you're watching us on YouTube. Subscribe if you're listening on Spotify or Apple. Give us a 5-star rating. It really does help out. Hope you enjoy your weekend. We'll be back again next week.